looking out on the audience, it's nice to see empty chairs. Those of us that were in the state board hearing the other day where they tried to do a hearing and it was standing room only, and they got us about 15 minutes into it, and fire marshal asked them to cease. So we may have a few technical problems here this morning, but we'll endure those in compared to having to cancel an entire day of it. So, okay, start with introductions. My far right, Mike Dunker, Riodell, Heidi Harris, Sellier, Bill Massey, Forestville, John Corbett, McKinleyville, David Noren, Sebastopol, Carol Dean, Santa Rosa, and Vice Chair Jeff Hales from Eureka. And would our executive officer want to do any introductions of staff?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have with me to my right is Mr. Luis Rivera, who is our assistant executive officer, one of our attorneys, Ms. Niemeyer. And in the audience, we have Samantha Olson, your other counsel. A number of staff, I'm not going to introduce everybody. They will be coming up as their items comes up. But certainly for admin assist, we've got Patty Corsi, who's, please pay attention to her. Make sure you're recording. And, of course, Gene Lockett and Greg Nash.
Okay, thank you. We'll go on to election of officers.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Massey.
I would like to nominate yourself, Mr. Bob Anderson, as our chair once again for 2009.
Second.
All right. We could have a filibuster, maybe. Or... All right. All in favor of that?
Aye.
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 And vice chair?
I'd like to nominate Mr. Chairman Jeff Hales.
I'll second that.
Jeff Hales, Board Member Hales.
All right. Any comment? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All right. Very good. Do we have any ex parte communication or
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Norton.
I want to report that I attended a meeting at the request of the Sonoma County Farm Bureau, their animal subcommittee meeting with Scott Gerges. We've been working, as many of you know, on a permit for dairies, and EPA recently promulgated and published in Federal Register new confined animal space or confined animal operation rules. So those somewhat meld together and overlap. So they wanted to talk about that at the same time we're, I think, reengaging with these groups in this permit process. So it was good. I think we're a good working relation.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Mess.
Since our last meeting in December, I have met and discussed with both federal, state, and local elected officials various items on West County sewers.
Okay. Today we don't have a state board liaison. No report from the board chair. We have board member reports. And any executive officer at this time, we'll take it up later. Public forum. We have time set aside to hear comments from the public on items not on our agenda. I don't have any cards in front of me. Anyone care to make a comment? All right. We'll go on to approval of minutes from the December meeting.
Mr. Chair.
I
note what I believe is one correction. On the public forum, there is comments from Felicia Pace, and I believe Mr. Pace was not at our December meeting.
Does that conform? It's on the very bottom of the first page.
And with that correction, I would give you a motion to accept.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Very good. We have two items uncontested, 1A and 2. Do we have any contesting of the uncontested?
I would give you a motion to accept the uncontested items on the agenda.
Second.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Oh, pardon me. Before we that vote, is there any member of the public that wants to speak? And we'll redo the vote just so we procedurally made that mistake before. I don't want to keep making that mistake of not asking for public comment on it. But,
yeah.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
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 Thank you.
See, we did manage to contest the uncontested. And it was self-inflicted.
All right. We're going to item three, REMCO.
Next matter up will be REMCO, and Jan Goble of your staff will give the opening presentation.
All right. I'll begin by reading the statement. This is the time and place for a hearing by the California Regional Water Quality Control Board in the North Coast Region to consider adoption of a mitigated negative declaration, environmental checklist, and waste discharge requirements, order number R1-2009-0001 for in-situ groundwater treatment for the Willits Environmental Remediation Trust, former REMCO hydraulics facility. This item has been properly noticed. Sheet explaining the procedures for this hearing is available at the handout table. Will all those who expect to give testimony in this matter please stand? Raise your right hand and take the following oath. Do you swear or affirm that you will tell the truth in this matter? Time we'll start with staff presentation.
Good morning. My name is Jan Goble of your staff. The item before you today is a public hearing to consider adoption of waste discharge requirements, order number R1-2009-0001, for an in-situ volatile organic groundwater treatment at the former REMCO hydraulics facility in Willits. You have in your agenda package a staff report, a response to comments, including all of the letters through the public comment period, a mitigated negative declaration, initial study checklist, draft waste discharge requirements, and a monitoring reporting program. I would like to enter the file into the hearing record. The former REMCO hydraulics facility is located at 934 South Main Street in the city of Willits. During its operational days, REMCO was known as the largest machine shop and chrome plating facility west of the Mississippi. This is an aerial map of the REMCO facility in the surrounding area, and it is a little bit old. The homes that you see on the north side of the plant, this is the REMCO property, they've been purchased by the trust and they've been demolished so they can investigate and clean up the site. Highway 101 is located here. This is Highway 20. This is the California Western Railroad tracks, also known as the Skunk Line. This is a school, the Bechtel Grove Middle School. This is the Safeway parking lot. And there are three gasoline service stations located here, here, and here. There's a small stream that flows along the railroad tracks here that discharges to Bechtel Creek. Bechtel Creek is flowing in this direction. And Broadus Creek is located here. The stormwater runoff at the site flows to the north of the plant, and it's culverted here and goes underneath the freeway and discharges to Bechtel Creek. Groundwater at the site is flowing northeast, so from this corner in this direction. The REMCO property is about 9.2 acres, and the buildings comprise about 3.5 acres. There's a series of buildings that were constructed in the years that you see here, such as 1973. The facility started operations as a machine shop in 1945 and began chrome plating in the 60s. Remco operated as a machine shop and chrome plating facility until it closed in 1995. Chemicals used at the plant include solvents as degreasers, petroleum products as cutting oils, and hexavalent chromium for their plating operations. They had a lot of spills and improper disposal of these chemicals during the operational life of the plant that resulted in soil and groundwater contamination. The primary chemicals of concern in groundwater are volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, and 1,4-dioxane, which is a solvent stabilizer. Hexavalent chromium was a primary chemical of concern. However, previous in-situ treatments have reduced the concentration significantly. The Regional Water Board has overseen the site for well over 30 years. The site is also subject to an environmental consent decree between the City of Willits and the former owners of the Remco plant. And we're not a party to this consent decree. The consent decree established the Willits Environmental Remediation Trust, who is overseeing the site investigation and cleanup. There's been multiple cleanup orders, extensive investigations of soil and groundwater, 4 pilot studies, a full-scale chromium treatment, a groundwater extraction and treatment system, and other remedial actions. This map is just for illustration purposes only. It shows the locations where soil samples have been collected, grab groundwater samples, monitoring wells, and sediment samples along here. There are over 136 groundwater monitoring wells at the site and well over 200 soil borings. The two areas with the dense dots here are areas where pilot studies have been conducted at the site and one full-scale chrome cleanup here. And I'm going to be talking about those pilot studies in just a few minutes. When you look at this map, the majority of the work that you see here was done in the last 10 years. This is a map of the VOC, or solvent plume, and this represents the total summed VOCs at the site. This outside line here, contour line, represents 10 parts per billion. The extent of the solvent contamination is contained primarily within the boundaries of the property. And I want to note at this point that the proposed in-situ treatment project is focusing on the areas with the highest levels of VOCs, about 1,000 parts per billion, located here, here, and here at the site. This next map shows the two monitoring wells where we have detectable levels of hexavalent chromium, one here and one over here. The hexavalent chromium plume has been largely remediated through this past in-situ treatment project, and the majority of the wells are below the detection limit. Now we have a site that has a solvent plume that needs to be remediated. There's been a lot of remedial actions conducted at the site, and for groundwater, there's a groundwater extraction and treatment system. Groundwater is extracted, treated, and discharged under permit to the City of Willits wastewater treatment plant. This is a picture showing the groundwater treatment system. What you see here are 2 large granulated activated carbon units that treat the groundwater before it's discharged to the sanitary sewer. The next remedial action is the excavation of solvent-contaminated soils. And this is a picture showing the excavation of those contaminated soils. The excavation was located on the north side of the plant. Over 4,000 tons of contaminated soils were removed and hauled off to a permitted landfill. This photo shows the shoring of the excavation here, and the depth was about 20 feet. The next remedial action was the removal of the vertical chrome plating tanks, and that occurred in late 2003 and 2004. It took about 4 months to pull all of the tanks, abandon them too. This is a picture showing one of the vertical tanks coming up out of the ground. REMCO had these vertical chrome plating tanks to plate large hydraulic cylinders. They had many contracts throughout the world and with our military. Some of the hydraulic cylinders were used for missile silos, nuclear submarines, dams, gun barrels, and many other applications. Other remedial actions at the site include many in-situ treatment projects. For the chrome area, there were two pilot studies that were conducted. One of the pilot studies looked at molasses as a reducing agent for chromium, and the other one looked at calcium polysulfide, which is a lime sulfur. Two other pilot studies were done at the west side of the property near the paint shop, and one study looked at the use of molasses to dechlorinate VOCs, and the other a soy oil. And in 2004, a full-scale hexavalent chromium in-situ project was conducted using molasses. This is a slide showing the injection process. You see the geoprobe. It's a direct push rig. It has pushed this rod into the ground. They've injected molasses at various depths. When they're done injecting, they pull this rod out of the ground, they grout the hole, and they move to the next spot. So how does the in-situ treatment process work? This is a slide showing the dechlorination process. The reducing agents, when injected into the ground, provide a food source for the existing microorganisms. These microorganisms consume the molasses and oil, and then they consume the chlorinated VOCs, thus breaking down the VOCs to carbon dioxide and water. I'd like to quickly walk you through the dechlorination of PCE and TCE. Both PCE and TCE can be parent compounds. And when you remove a chlorine from PCE, you now have TCE. And similarly, you remove a chlorine from TCE and you have cis and trans 1,2 dichloroethane, or DCE. Continues to break down to vinyl chloride, which is a more toxic solvent than any of the others that you see. Vinyl chloride ultimately breaks down to carbon dioxide and water. And carbon dioxide and water. The in-situ treatment process using molasses and oil has been very successful at the REMCO plant. The in-situ treatment process is a safe and effective means of cleaning up the REMCO site. The four pilot studies and the main hexavalent chromium cleanup have been successful in reducing the levels of hexavalent chromium to just a couple wells at the site. And to give you an example, before treatment, hexavalent chromium exceeded 400,000 parts per billion in groundwater, and now the majority of these wells are less than the detection limit of one part per billion. As I mentioned earlier, the hexavalent chromium treatment is essentially complete. For VOCs, the pilot studies and the full-scale chromium cleanup was successful in enhancing the dechlorination of VOCs. The dechlorination process is occurring naturally at the REMCO site, but the in-situ treatment accelerates the process. The Los Angeles Regional Water Board and the Central Valley Regional Board have adopted general waste discharge requirements for the in-situ treatment process for these types of reducing agents, molasses and oils. They recognize that the in-situ treatment process works, and they've issued these general requirements to accelerate the permit process and expedite the cleanup. The in-situ remediation processes are widely used in the Central Valley and the Los Angeles region areas. So the proposed project before the board today is for an in-situ treatment of VOCs in groundwater. The proposed project consists of injecting molasses and a vegetable oil into shallow groundwater at five initial areas at the site. The waste discharge requirements contain a process for additional injections. The draft requirements also include a monitoring program and a contingency plan. To comply with CEQA, we've prepared a mitigated negative declaration, an environmental checklist, initial study, and the draft requirements, monitoring program, and the CEQA documents have been circulated for public review and comment. The draft requirements and monitoring program include mitigation measures, including this contingency plan, to reduce the potential impacts of the project to less than significant. Regional Water Board staff was very conservative in evaluating the potential impacts from this project. The potential impacts that have been identified is the potential migration of VOCs off-site from the temporary increase in toxicity from the breakdown of PCE and TCE to vinyl chloride during the in-situ treatment process. As I mentioned before, vinyl chloride is more toxic than the parent compounds. Vapor intrusion was also identified as a potential impact. The potential migration off-site of the temporary increases in toxicity and the potential for vapor intrusion had been mitigated to a level of insignificance through groundwater monitoring and on-site containment as required by the draft waste discharge requirements in the monitoring program. Off-site migration of the in-situ treatment process is considered a significant impact. So this is a map of the site showing the injection areas and the groundwater monitoring well network. These are the injection areas here, and some of the wells that you see here are located within the injection areas. We have wells just down gradient of the injection areas in here, and wells along the property boundary here. Because of the large number of wells that you see on this map and the comprehensive monitoring program, the increased toxicity can be promptly detected before it migrates off-site and mitigated by extracting groundwater. Monitoring wells can be quickly connected to the existing treatment system that's located right here. And the treatment system has adequate capacity to handle these additional connections. The Willits Trust has also conducted modeling of the extraction wells on the north side of the plant property to demonstrate there's adequate hydraulic control to contain contaminated groundwater on the site. The mitigation for potential vapor intrusion is the same as for groundwater, and that is to contain the treatment process on the site. Air monitoring was conducted during the four pilot studies and the full-scale chromium cleanup. And air monitoring was also conducted in some of the homes that you saw on the north side of the plant before they were torn down. The air monitoring results did not detect VOCs inside the building or outside the building above background concentrations. The air sampling results of the homes detected a VOC that exceeded a health-based criteria, but that VOC is not associated with the REMCO plant. Other impacts such as noise and potential nuisance odors have been mitigated in the negative declaration. For noise, the discharge is required to comply with the City of Willits noise ordinance that limits the hours of operation. And for nuisance odor conditions, the molasses will be contained in closed vats and sealed piping. And just by simply keeping the building door shut during the injection process inside will prevent molasses odors from escaping the building. The in-situ treatment project was put on the agenda twice last year and was removed. and all of the comment letters that we received up until the comment deadline of January 5th are included in your agenda package. And these letters have been responded to in our response to comments. We've received 6 letters from Mr. Ken Berry and 1 letter from the Willits Citizens for Environmental Justice. The City of Willits has submitted 2 letters. One of the letters from the city was beyond the public comment period, and so it's been copied for you and is in your materials in front of you. The City of Willits, their last letter showed their support for the project. The main objections to the proposed project by Mr. Berry and the Willits Citizens for Environmental Justice involve our CEQA process. Samantha's going to go over our CEQA legal issues following my presentation. A couple of days ago, we received an additional letter from Mr. Berry. It's a 10-page letter, and I think it's copied on purple-colored paper for you. Mr. Berry raises no new issues, but reiterates the same issues in his previous letters. All of these comments by Mr. Berry and the Willits Citizens for Environmental Justice are directed at the ability to detect and adequately contain contaminants from migrating off-site. Staff has responded to these comments, and we believe these issues have been adequately addressed. That concludes my presentation. Samantha's going to talk about CEQA issues, and then the Willits Trust is going to give a presentation on their project.
Okay. Thank you. Board member, have questions? Okay, we'll go on to the legal analysis.
Good job.
Good morning, members of the board. Chairman Anderson, my name is Samantha Olson, your other attorney, other counsel. Ken Berry is not present today, but he did submit 6 previous comment letters on this item, and then we received another letter on Tuesday. That's 10 pages. In his transmittal, Mr. Berry concedes that this letter, quote, conveys nothing new. After careful review, staff agrees that the late comment letter does not introduce anything new. Rather, it appears to reiterate the previous comments submitted and is an attempt to summarize his arguments. Your agenda package includes our written response to comments, which provides great detail, but I thought I'd take a few minutes to just go over a couple CEQA legal issues, if you're interested. It may not be necessary, but the gravamen of Mr. Berry's argument is that a mitigated negative declaration is not the appropriate CEQA document because there is a potential significant effect that's not mitigated. He would prefer that we do a full-blown environmental impact report. EIR. A mitigated neg deck is appropriate under CEQA if, and here's a standard, when revisions to the project would avoid or mitigate effects of a project to a point where clearly no effect would occur. That means so that there is no substantial evidence in light of the whole record that the project as mitigated will have a significant effect on the environment. That's the standard. And it's a fairly low threshold. So staff conducted a very careful and independent analysis, as required under CEQA, and made that determination. The project with the mitigation, including the extraction contingency plan, et cetera, will absolutely not have a significant impact on the environment. It's less than significant. The project, in fact, is designed to significantly improve groundwater quality over a shortened period of time. Mitigation measures were crafted to ensure that no impacts would occur. So under CEQA, significant effect on the environment means substantial or potentially substantial adverse change in any of the physical conditions within the area affected by the project. Project means the whole of the action which has the potential for resulting in a physical change. So it's important here to understand that the project here is the cleanup effort, not the contaminated property. To identify significant effects, we must compare the existing environment, here the contaminated piece parcel, with the project, which is the proposed cleanup. So we identified as potentially significant any migration of the increased toxicity migrating off the site as significant. That's how we define that threshold of significance. And our mitigation measure makes sure that that doesn't happen. There's no possibility that this increased interim toxicity will migrate off the property because there's ample monitoring wells well before it reaches the edge of the property that will detect whether the injection resulted in a heightened vinyl chloride that's moving toward the property perimeter. We have an extraction treatment around the entire perimeter that allows them to convert monitoring wells into extraction wells that will pull the groundwater out before it leaves the property. Similarly, we define the threshold of significance conservatively for air impacts and required mitigation to ensure that those don't occur. These decisions are explained thoroughly and are supported by substantial evidence in the record. Mr. Berry has not submitted a fair argument that the project as mitigated will cause a significant effect on the environment. Substantial evidence means enough relevant information and reasonable inference made from that relevant information that a fair argument could be made to support a conclusion. That's the definition of substantial evidence in CEQA. Substantial evidence does not include argument, speculation, unsubstantiated opinion, or narrative. Mr. Kenberry is not an expert. He has submitted arguments, but they're not fair arguments. He submitted evidence, but it's not substantial evidence. My second point is that Mr. Berry, if you read his comments, confuses the environmental baseline condition again and again. This is evidenced first by his incorrect assertion that the remedial investigation is somehow an EIR. The remedial investigation is just one of many documents that help define the extent of the contamination. That is, the extent of the contamination is the existing baseline here. His confusion over this issue is also evidenced by his comments about the presence of dioxin. Whether dioxin exists or not on the site is irrelevant for the project before you, which is a cleanup project for VOCs. Another example is Mr. Berry's comments on the migration of groundwater, contaminated groundwater. Contaminated groundwater exists on this property, and it may migrate. Our inquiry is whether the heightened toxicity is going to migrate. So the relevant inquiry is whether our action is going to make this worse. So I just want, you know, that's what CEQA is all about. We're going to compare what's there now to what we're proposing to do. So finally, Mr. Berry makes several charges that staff lacks the expertise to evaluate the impacts of this project. These statements are untrue. Your staff consists of highly qualified engineers. They've been doing this a long time. They do it well. And moreover, his suggestion that we need to hire a consultant is inconsistent with the way regulatory agencies such as ours oversee cleanups. Staff here has made a great effort to try to sort out his reasoning, see if we'd missed anything, and we found nothing. At the end of the day, Mr. Berry concludes in this January 27th letter that, quote, "I'm not necessarily opposed to the injection of molasses to clean up VOCs. My sole interest is that the regional board prepare an EIR." I think his concerns really stem from whether the trust ultimately will take actions that leads to an acceptable level of cleanup. I think that's a legitimate interest, but it's not a CEQA issue. That's what I have. Thanks very much. I can answer any questions. I mean, it's too bad Mr. Berry is not attending. We could engage in a dialogue, but right. he's definitely interested in a parcel, and so we wanted to take the time to make sure you understood his issues.
Okay. Mr. Norton.
Janice, can I ask you a question that it goes back and somewhat ties back to that? And I'm sorry I didn't ask you this before.
That's okay.
The contingency plan here is that we're going to inject molasses into the groundwater as an in-situ treatment, go through reductive dechlorination, and the worry is, or the concern is, from Mr. Berry, is that we could have off-site migration of VOCs, including vinyl chloride. The board package also includes metals, which are antimony, arsenic, and iron. And arsenic has been something that's happened out here before.
It has.
Mobilization. The contingency plan on this is that they have a treatment plant that includes, it looks like from your slide, granulated activated carbon. Can you describe a little bit more that contingency plan and that treatment system from the standpoint specifically to arsenic? Because from a VOC standpoint, arsenic granulated activated carbon would work very well, properly sized. But how about the arsenic side of it?
We've been pumping and treating from, maybe we can go back and show you on the map.
Yeah, and I apologize to make you go back.
That's okay. Not sure where we are. I'll keep going. Sorry about that. Okay. As I pointed out, the groundwater treatment system is here. We've been pumping, the Willits Trust has been pumping from GMX-7A, which is a monitoring well in this location, because we did have the mobilization of arsenic in groundwater, and we wanted to contain it on site. We didn't want it to migrate off site. What's interesting to note about arsenic is that the arsenic that was mobilized was naturally occurring at the site. It wasn't a chemical that was introduced by REMCO operations. And the concentrations in soil were quite low. The GAC treatment, which is the carbon treatment system, was installed in the 1990s, and they used carbon because they had such a mixed soup of chemicals at REMCO. Carbon's not typically used for metals, but it has been effective in reducing chrome in the carbon vessels themselves, and it has also worked for arsenic.
Is that the preferred, or is that the proposed, if arsenic did get mobilized in this, as Mr. Berry contends, would granulated activated carbon be the choice to actually mitigate that?
It's being used right now, and it's working. The sampling results of the influence have shown levels of arsenic, and in the midfluent, which is in between the two vessels, and then the effluent, it's removing arsenic and all the other metals.
And that system's permitted by City of Willits, and that effluent is going then to the wastewater treatment plant, which is similarly able to handle, or they have established waste discharge requirements on that treatment plant?
Yes, we have waste discharge requirements on the treatment facility, and the trust has a permit with the city to discharge. But the levels are below the detection limit for all of the chemicals. We have seen breakthrough through one of the GAC units, and they replaced one of the units, moved, which is typically done, the second unit to the first place, and then replace the other one. Kind of confusing.
And as far as that goes, the contingency plan is a time-based system that if the interior monitoring wells detect these mobilizations, that they have time, in essence, to ramp up, put in additional extraction wells, even increase the size of the treatment system itself.
They would have time. The system has a lot of capacity right now. I think the system is a 25 GPM system, and they're using only a fraction of that.
Thank you for all your work on this. It's actually very nice to see this thing maybe turning a corner and coming down a home stretch. And I know you've worked on this for a long time, I know, and I want to thank you for that. I support the work that's proposed here, and I think it's good.
Thank you. It's an exciting project. It's really exciting to see that a site is actually being cleaned up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
Good morning. My name is Ann Farr, and I am the trustee for the Willits Environmental Remediation Trust responsible for investigating and cleaning up this project. Despite the title of trustee, I actually am a geohydrologist, and my first role on this project starting in 1997 was as a site project manager. And then in 2001, I was asked by the court to also take over the role as trustee. I have with me here today Terry James, who's with Jacobson, James & Associates. He has been working on the project since 1999 and doing the investigation and cleanup for the work for the trust. So between the two of us, we certainly should be able to answer any question you have about either historical work or certainly about the work we're proposing today. Is there a... Okay, but I have to see.
This is the pointer.
Okay.
You have the first button. This will take you to your next slide. That'll go back.
Okay, great. Thank you. Jan gave an excellent overview of the project, so I'll try to go through this relatively quickly, and I don't know if it's the way you usually do things, but I certainly would be happy to entertain any questions as we go through this.
And hold up one second.
And real quick, sorry to interrupt. This is Samantha Olson, staff counsel. I just want to clarify that the project before you is not the way Ms. Farah was just speaking about the general overall cleanup project. And so just to avoid any confusion, let's just clarify there are many projects in this world, and the project before you is the VOC treatment. The project that Ann was referring to is, you know, the cleanup of this site as a whole. Thank you.
Sorry about that. I was using project generically. this is just an overview of what I'd like to cover. The first two bullets, and I believe you have a copy of these slides, the first two bullets will just go over in general what we've done on this site in terms of using this exact same technology, as well as, again, what are the conditions at the site in terms of what are we addressing by this proposed interim remedial action. And then the next two bullets will go into specifically what are our objectives of this IRA, what are we trying to accomplish, and what is the remedial technology that is being proposed. And then I'll go over the last two bullets, which show that we actually have done this on the site through a pilot study. Jan mentioned that there were two pilot studies for VOCs on the area, and I'm going to show you performance to show you that this really does work and is extremely successful. And we believe will greatly increase the time for us to meet the ultimate objectives at the site. And then a little bit more on the details again on exactly what we will be doing. As mentioned before, this is an in-situ or in-place process, which basically means we're not taking anything out of the ground. It is a process that has been proven successful across the state. Jan mentioned it's used prevalently in the Central Valley and Los Angeles regions, but it's also used across California, across the U.S., across the world. It's very well accepted as a technology for exactly this type of application. Effectively, what we're doing is just trying to speed up what Mother Nature would do, albeit too slowly for us to wait that much time to be effective. It's a natural degradation process that does occur, and so we're trying to speed that process up at the site. We have done this successfully at the site. Again, we did a pilot study, as well as when we did the hexavalent chromium IRA, in which we also injected molasses, there was also VOCs present in the same area, and it was successful in reducing the concentrations of the VOCs in that area as well. So simply what we're proposing here is an expansion of what has already been proven successful at this site to a broader area on the same property that the trust owns. You saw this slide earlier. The trust has done an extensive amount of investigation over the last, we're going on 11 plus years now. And this figure is not meant to try to show you anything specific. I just point out again the area. Oops, excuse me. I didn't mean to do that. Let me go back. Okay. Meant to do this one. The boundaries, just so people are aware, right as I go around here is the facility boundary, and then this patch of land in here is land that the trust owns, so now is all part of trust-owned land. And so there's been an extensive number of sampling that has been conducted at the site, which I probably am I supposed to point it at anywhere in particular, or will it? Oh, there we go. Okay. Specifically, though, the zone we're looking at is the shallow groundwater at the site where we have VOCs. I think what's important here, and you've seen a picture or something that looks similar to this from JAM, but what's important to think about at this site is despite the fact that there was releases going back to probably 1945 when operations started at this facility, really the contamination does not extend very far away from where those operations occurred, and that's really due to very slow groundwater movement at the site. It's due to these chemicals naturally being retarded or sorbing to the soil, so that essentially prevents them from moving as fast as the groundwater. And then also naturally, as I mentioned, degradation is occurring at the site. So we get this picture or this halo from the site that is relatively close to where the initial operations were. Our objectives in conducting this interim remedial action are to reduce the concentrations of the VOCs, to make substantial progress towards cleanup of the site, and do it in as timely a manner as we possibly can. I'll go through quickly. I think Jan already covered most of this. What we're doing is putting in food sources, food grade substances into the subsurface. In this case, it's a molasses solution and an oil solution, so molasses and oil mixed in a water. And that provides a food source to microorganisms that exist naturally. We're not introducing any microorganisms. They naturally exist in the subsurface, and they can use that as a food source to help break down these VOCs in the subsurface, with the end products being carbon dioxide and water. I think Jan went over sort of the process on the right, where we have as parent compounds either a perchloroethylene, a PCE, or a trichloroethane, a TCA, and ultimately both of those can go through vinyl chloride, ultimately resulting, oops, I'm sorry, I'm not used to this thing. Is it twice to go back? I'm sorry. Ultimately producing the carbon dioxide and water. Again, the important thing really is this is a natural process. We're not doing anything that wouldn't happen otherwise, but we are trying to speed it up, and speed it up actually quite substantially. I wanted to show the success of this exact... I am obviously not good on this. The success of the technology at the site. The pilot study area that we did in 2003, where we did the injections, is shown on the left-hand part of the screen. And I'm going to blow up that area on the next slide, so if you just sort of envision where that is. And this is the area where we did the pilot study. The concentrations in the middle are 1,000 or greater of what we call PCE equivalents, which just means PCE and its related degradation products. So that's where we had a hot zone out there to the west end of the building. And I'm going to show you the results from two of the wells that I have highlighted there to show you what has happened there and what we want to have happen at the rest of the site. So for those of you who are used to seeing these, you might not need a discussion, but I'll try to explain here. On the bottom, we have the four primary chemicals, PCE, TCE, cis-12-DC, and vinyl chloride. So as it degrades, it goes from left to right in compounds. So what you see here, the black line is when we did our injections. And prior to injections, we had relatively low levels of PCE and TCE and mostly cis. So what that tells us is naturally things were being degraded. We know that it was going on naturally. We know that the microorganisms were present and that what we needed to do was to speed that process up. So we injected on the black line. It took some while for the microorganism colony to build up to start being able to really attack that. And then we see almost a textbook example of the cis dichloroethylene going down virtually to nothing, the vinyl chloride coming up as this goes down, and then going down itself. You can't really see the two parent compounds here because of the scale, so I've just blown it up on the next slide. So you can see initially there was some levels there in the hundreds of parts per billion, and about the same time frame they've dropped to nothing. As an example, this well is a little further down gradient from where we injected, but you see the exact same thing happening, but just a little later in time. So again, we have the injection at the black line. this yellow, I really apologize here. I keep hitting the wrong buttons. You see the dichloroethylene staying relatively stable, and then it starts to decrease. Commensurate with that decrease, you have a temporary increase of vinyl chloride, and then decrease again. So again, this is sort of textbook of what you want to see, what we have seen, and really what we want to apply to the rest of the site. This, again, is just a blow-up of the PCE and TECE on small scale. Shows the same thing, where it's come down to virtually non-detectable levels. So briefly here, again, I'll go over. There's three main elements of the program that we've proposed. There's an injection part of the program. That's the first thing to be done. The monitoring after that, and our contingency plan. So I just want to talk about each of those elements briefly. There's five areas that are being proposed for injection. One, two, three, and four are all new areas. Five is where the pilot study was done, and we want to essentially give it another extra dose of food so that they continue and complete the process a little bit more quickly within that area. Importantly on this slide to note is that we have a significant, what I'll call buffer zone between our injection areas and our property boundary, which is here on Franklin Avenue. That gives us, given the slow rate of transport, if you remember again, the VOCs aren't moving very fast on their own, so we have numerous monitoring wells between all these injection areas and our property boundary, so we have ample time to monitor the progress and if we need to put in extraction wells. Jan showed a similar picture. This just shows that we're not talking about a huge rig. We're not talking about anything that's going to have an impact to the community. But essentially, we go down from about a 2-foot depth to a 22-foot depth below ground surface and inject these food sources. So we get it all the way through that shallow zone. We pull it back out. We grout the hole, and we move. So there's nothing left in place after we've done the injections. This just highlights the number of wells that we have. There's numerous wells within what you've seen in the monitoring reporting program. In addition, we have a separate monitoring reporting program for the site that has even additional monitoring that we routinely do. And this just gives you a sense. It's color-coded if you want to look at it, but it gives you a sense of the numerous wells we have and where those wells are in relation to the proposed injection. And this just gives you a different perspective of the same thing. It shows where we have higher concentrations of VOCs at the site. And you can see that all these 1,000 contours are pretty much lined up with where we're doing the injections. Again, we're trying to hit where we have the higher concentrations. We're trying to do it well within our property boundaries to essentially promote the degradation that's going on. This last slide now shows, gives you some information on the contingency plan and what we could do in terms of controlling the groundwater. This first slide shows currently the groundwater extraction system and its impact on the site. There are three wells of which we're currently extracting from, this well on the eastern boundary, and there's two wells here. This blue shading area shows the area that's being controlled by those extraction wells. So you can see that a large part of the site is already being controlled by extraction wells that we have operating. And to answer your question, actually, partially about the treatment system, there are two 10,000-pound vessels, so they're actually huge compared to our capacity. And over an eight-year period, we've only changed it out one vessel out once. We successfully have treated the arsenic. Even if we start to get something through on a midfluent, we have years of time to either put on another treatment or change out the vessel. So that will easily be able to handle if we do tend to get the arsenic. The second slide, and I see here that's a little bit shaded, but you can see that it's projected adding on potentially four wells. We have existing wells in place. That can easily be tied back very quickly into our extraction system, and this is to show that if need be, we can easily put wells on place that will completely control the groundwater on our own property. So in conclusion, we have already demonstrated at this site through pilot studies as well as an IRA at the hexachrome area that this can be done effectively and it can be done safely. The work will be done in a manner that won't impact the community. We do have a very comprehensive set of monitoring network at this site, so we'll know what is going on, and certainly in ample time before we potentially would have to put any additional extraction well if that becomes necessary. So that is the end of my presentation.
Does Terry want to make any comment or,
answer? Sure, any questions.
Okay. Mr. Corbett.
Yes, I wanted to make sure we understand Mr. Barry's concern on the EIR CEQA issue. Are you folks also equally concerned?
We're not concerned that an EIR is required by any means. We certainly agree with the board's position relative to that in the mitigated negative deck.
Okay, thank you. And I had, are you unaware of any significant alternative that hasn't been considered in this process that's available?
No, as part of, I didn't go over the history. We put together an IRA work plan back in November of 2007. And as part of that, we looked at other things we could do besides this. And really the main thing would be to do a groundwater extraction and treatment system. But it would be extremely slow. It wouldn't, essentially what we'd be doing is we'd be waiting for nature to essentially let the chemicals get to us, and it really would not be very effective at cleaning up the site.
And you have no reason to doubt the pilot studies that showed the effectiveness of the treatment?
No, not at all. We have, actually, I only gave you two wells. I think in those areas we have, I don't know, 20 wells. That was one of those areas where we were, you know, had pock marks of, you could probably see it maybe on that one, but that was just two examples. It's a consistent behavior we're seeing within those areas.
And then the primary purpose of this project is environmental remediation?
Yes, it is.
And that's all. Thank you.
Mr. Massey.
Yes, I'm kind of curious. The volume of molasses and vegetable oil that we inject, how much are we putting in there, and how do we calculate that?
We're putting in an each hole. What's the total that we're at now? Two, how many hundreds of gallons per hole?
It's 500 gallons per hole of a dilute remedial solution. I think it's 50 gallons of molasses at each location or 27 gallons of the oil at each location.
Diluted within the water. And we came up with the volume based on looking at what our density of our samples works. We want to get complete coverage within these zones. And then the concentration was based on the performance from the pilot studies of how much molasses or how much oil we needed to be putting in to essentially get an impact from that injection.
And with the process that we're looking at, assume that we kind of misjudged. Is there any deleterious effect that may come from too much molasses, too much vegetable oil, or would it simply be eaten up by microbes that don't have anything else to do?
There's not necessarily a deleterious effect. The problem is it's difficult. I mean, you can imagine a molasses is exactly, you know, what we have in our cupboards, and we have to basically dilute it to be able to inject it. Otherwise, it's basically too viscous, too thick to really get in effectively. We tried, when we did our pilot study, we initially tried a higher concentration of the molasses and had problems just with the mere mechanisms of getting it injected. So this proved to be sort of an effective, it was effective once we put in about a 10% solution. We could get it in, and it ended up building up the microbe population so that effectively could degrade at a faster rate.
And if we put too much in, what do we get?
You mean in terms of concentration or in terms of more volume?
More volume than the chemicals that we're actually trying to no, get the...
It wouldn't hurt anything if you had too much. Essentially, if you put so much in that there was... you know, essentially, you built up more microbe population or expanded, it's not going to have a deleterious impact to the subsurface. Essentially, it might actually help speed things up because they could actually consume or help degrade the VOCs more quickly, but there's practically a limit on how much you can get in. From a volume perspective, you might just have more overlap in your essential cones of influence from your injection. And essentially, you can only put so much more liquid into something that's already saturated, so you have some limitations in terms of how much you can actually physically get into the subsurface.
Thank you.
Mr. Dunker?
Yeah, part of my question was the answer about the molasses dilution mixture. It's obviously mixed prior to injection. You just said that, so that answered part of my question. The other question is, how is it mixed?
Do you want to talk about the mechanism?
Yeah. We get the remedial solutions in I think they're 220-gallon tanks, and we decant that into another mixing tank where we add water for molasses. It's about 450 gallons, and then we just recirculate that using a pump. So there's a valve that comes out the bottom and a valve that goes in the top, and in between there is a pump that just keeps circulating it, and it mixes it pretty well.
Okay, so it's a continual mix while it's being injected.
It mixes up continuously, and then once you go to inject, you stop that mix and you change the valving, and then you go into the ground.
Because it soaks it up.
Correct, yeah.
Use it all at once.
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Norton.
Can I ask you, this is an A-zone treatment, is that correct? This has been characterized as having three water-bearing zones, and this is an A-zone treatment specifically?
Yes, it's in the shallow zone.
And fair enough. From that standpoint, is the B zone and C zone similarly impacted as the A zone?
No, actually it isn't. We didn't show the figures there. We don't have any VOCs now in the C zone. In the B zone, there is a very small area. I could go back to the thing, but around the tanks themselves were essentially conduits that allow some stuff to get in. So right around those zones, we actually have a little bit of hex chrome. Jan had pointed on the map, one of those two wells was a B-zone well where we have hex chrome. And we, as part of the pilot study, we did inject molasses in the B-zone, but we didn't get impact and reduction of that hex chrome. So the thought is that we're going to probably have to go back in and do some limited extraction and treatment in those areas that would also address the VOCs at that time.
So from a contingency standpoint question here, we have adequate monitoring and contingency planning for all water-bearing zones?
Yes.
And I see here, too, within this approval you're seeking, if you come back and do more than what you're proposing now, then it goes to our executive officer, and we have a say in that. Is that correct, Janice? And I'm sorry again to go around here, but okay. Thank you very much, Ann.
May I ask a question in terms of the time? What timeline when you, I mean, I'm going back to the chart where these chemicals degrade and get down into the low zero kind of numbers. Is this something that happens relatively soon after injection, or is this?
I can go back. There is a delay for it to start impacting. If you notice, I'm just going to go back here. Excuse me, to the second one. There was a delay, I'd say, of about 6 months, maybe as much as a year, for the cysts. Oh, let me go back. About 3 to 6 months after injection, we started seeing impact on the PCE and TCE. But if you remember, those were at fairly low concentrations. So we didn't see much change in the cysts during that time. There might have been some increase. And it took about a year or more for this cis-1,2-DCE to start degrading. And it wasn't, the vinyl chloride peaked, if you can look at this, let's see, approximately a year and a half or so after injections, and now it's been on a continual decline since then. So, you know, there is variability across the site on how quickly it reacts. But I would say that we would expect that this same sort of behavior happening again in these new areas when we do the injection, that we probably won't see vinyl chloride start to increase for probably about a year.
I get it. The bacteria that are doing this work naturally occurring, are they there because the chemicals are there, or are they there, you know, if you go half a mile away, you'd find the same concentration? And
In most areas, they're naturally existing, and they live off, these microorganisms can live on, you know, some sort of carbon matter, some sort of organic matter in the subsurface. There are different types of species, but essentially there are some that have the ability to degrade these VOCs. Now, we knew that they were present even before we started based on the fact that we already had, REMCO was not using Cis-1-2 DCE as a primary product. We knew they were using PCE and TCE. So the high presence of that dichloroethylene indicated that it was already occurring at the site. But what was happening is naturally the degradation rate or half-life of the DCE is, it's fairly slow at that point. A lot of sites you'll see sort of, I don't want to say an accumulation of DCE, but it's almost a stalling of that. It still is degrading, but it's going so slowly that essentially that DCE will stay around for a long time unless you essentially try to push it past that by helping these naturally existing microorganisms essentially build up and really be able to degrade those VOCs. So it should, I guess, you know, the short answer to your question probably was, yes, you should find it somewhere else. You don't always find it at every site, but it's pretty common that there will be some amount of these type of microorganisms present that you need to have this occur.
Anyone else?
Chairman Anderson, is this on? Is the mic on? I need to clarify the answer to the question asked by Member Noren about the procedures for additional injections. The way this WDR is set up right now, they come back to the executive officer. So the WDR contains a delegation to the executive officer. There is public comment, and there is additional review, and they need to submit a monitoring plan, but it does not come back to this board as it's presently drafted.
Okay. One other thing, too, I guess, on that also, it is constrained. It would be constrained to property owned by the REMCO Trust. So that is also a constraint that's inherent in even any brief proposal. It would have to be done on our own property.
Okay. I have one speaker card from the City of Willits, Paul Kaler.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, board members, staff. My name is Paul Kaler. I'm the Willits City Manager. I'm here to express to the board on behalf of my City Council that the City Council supports this WDR and the efforts of the Willits Trust, and ask for you to support it with your vote today. Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Any questions? Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Any final staff summation or comment?
I would just like to recommend that the board adopt the draft waste discharge requirements, which includes the mitigated negative declaration, initial study checklist. The order number is
R12009001. Okay. All right. Mr. Corbett.
Yes, I wanted to direct to legal counsel, but my strong recommendation is that we have two separate votes in this particular matter, that the very first one be the negative declaration, that the board have a very brief discussion so we have it clear that it's not being adopted after the fact and that it is the document that we're using for decision-making purposes. And I think we can just take the staff motion in the last part and have a motion for that, a second, and a brief discussion. I just think that would be a sounder procedure.
Thank you.
Mr. Massey.
Mr. Chair, I would give you, and I'm not quite sure whether we want to do the neg deck first or
yes.
All right, then I would give you a motion to accept the negative declaration.
Second. Very briefly, for discussion purposes, negative declarations, there is an element of judgment, in my opinion, involved in it on the size and the scope of the project, and I think we have a very extensive record that this is not a nuclear dumping site, that the government claims everything's mitigated, that this is a very small, discrete project. I also want to, having heard all the testimony, do not believe this is a serial project trying to get around cumulative impacts on cleanup on the site. I think the record establishes there's no viable alternative. We have a very sound database because of the prior wells, and the primary purpose of this project is environmental remediation, and we would not be able to protect the environment if we didn't proceed.
Okay.
I'll make a motion then that we accept the order number R12009-001.
All right. We'll take that in a moment.
Wait, pardon me. If we are going to divide this up, let's first have a motion to adopt.
There is a motion on the floor.
And, sorry, let's use it. It's not accepted. The motion would be to adopt the mitigated negative declaration and environmental checklist. Let's do that one first.
Right.
Comment on the motion on the mitigated neg dec? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Now, Mr.
Motion
Duncan.
So moved, as previously stated.
Second. Any comments on the adoption of the order? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Thank you very much.
And you can cart out your 23 feet of files now?
I do that often.
How many cookies? Is it possible to entertain a 5-minute?
It is. Great. That's what. We'll be back at 10 o'clock.